From Raleigh, North Carolina, it's The Leftovers with Jay and Jeff, a podcast dedicated to HBO's The Leftovers. So sit back, relax, and enjoy the show.
Welcome to The Leftovers podcast. My name is Jack.
And I'm dancing for joy.
And welcome to the show. Jay is here. Jay is here. You might hear him coughing and breathing, or what would you call the breathing he's doing? Erratic?
Erratic, rattling. It's almost as if we'll reveal a little bit of behind-the-scenes info for our listeners out here. Jay, over the course of the week since we recorded, entered himself in this weird sort of testing where a sitcom star from the 80s came to his house and told him about this new process where he'd be able to connect with the podcast that had left the Jay and Jack network. So that's what he's undergone. There have been side effects that have resulted. We're hoping to get Jay up in fighting condition by next week, but for now he is lurking behind the scenes dealing with the unfortunate radiative side effects that have come out of this experience.
And there he is. I think we can hear a cough from beyond from the departed.
But so anyway, it's just going to be Jack and I talking about this episode,
which was a fantastic episode.
It was so strange, but I loved it. And this shows how creatively audacious The Leftovers is at its core. I mean, I say it's probably might only be second to International Assassin in terms of just plain weirdness going on in an episode of The Leftovers. But it made me so excited. I mean, I love Nora Durst. I love the Nora Durst focused episodes. This was another one of those. But we already got so many answers, but we raised so many more questions at the same time. But it was an insane hour of television that I can't wait to break down.
And you don't mess with Nora. She has no heart. I mean, she's in so much pain. It's been a rough time for her, Nora Durst, that she's, you know, I feel bad for her, but I love her episodes. It's probably the best character on the show.
Any heartbreak or hole in her heart that was left as a result of the increasing amount of depression in her life has only just been tattooed over by a Wu-Tang Clan tattoo. So now that we're seeing Nora on the other side, we're starting to see, you know, her don't give an F attitude, specifically at the end of this with the whole Pillar Man saga. It'll be interesting to see, again, if we're comparing Nora to when we saw her at the end of the first episode, if she really is this Sarah. Now that we know how she gets to Australia, perhaps, it'll be interesting to sort of track this journey now over the course of the next six episodes to see exactly how she gets there.
Yeah, I really enjoyed this episode. Even the second time I watched it, it was still intense and still picking up a few things I didn't catch the first time. But anyway, if you like this show, and who doesn't? There's other shows on the Jay and Jack podcast. We have Fargo. Fargo's here. And Mike, do you know anything about this Fargo podcast?
Oh, I do. You betcha. So Jeremiah Panhorst and I, that, as you can tell, I am struggling with that accent, but I hope every episode of Fargo I can work closer and closer to it. Ewan McGregor, a British actor, does a better job at the accent than me. So that's
Can I be honest? I had to look it up. I go, who is this guy?
You didn't know who Ewan McGregor was, or you didn't recognize Ewan McGregor?
No, I didn't recognize him because, you know, he had my haircut. So I was looking at, who is this guy? And I'm like going, oh, you're kidding me.
No. Jack, you have like Fabio hair compared to what Ewan McGregor wears in that Ray Argus Filch-like rat weave that he has on. But yeah, Jeremiah and Panhorst and I are covering the third season of Fargo, which also just premiered last week. We did our first episode recap. You can find that on the main Jay and Jack feed, but on our dedicated feed at Fargo with Jeremiah and Mike. We also take feedback for that as well. So if you watch the episode on Wednesdays or Thursdays, we usually record Thursday night, and you want to send us questions or thoughts about the episode, you can reach out to us at fargowithmj@gmail.com. And I mean, I am definitely have no sort of complaints right now, considering that I get to talk about two of the best shows on TV right now for the Jay and Jack network.
And what I like about it, because people are asking, if you haven't seen season two, can you watch season three? And I saw season one, didn't see season two, and I watched the first episode and didn't miss a beat. So yeah, it's like a completely different series.
Yeah, so what I will say is that Fargo functions as an anthology series in a way, much like something like American Horror Story or American Crime Story or American Blank Story. Ryan Murphy apparently has a pattern when it comes to naming these series, but they take, you know, a different cast and tell a different story in a different time period in roughly the same area. I will say that seasons 1 and 2 are kind of connected in that there are characters in which their prequel forms exist in season 2. Season 3 seems to be apparently extremely distant from the other two. So I say, if you want to find a time to jump into Fargo, now would be the time to do so. Though I will warn, if you want to go back and watch seasons 1 and 2 at any point in time, Jeremiah and I do dip our toes occasionally without hopefully plunging our heads in like Kevin does, Police Chief Kevin at the end of the episode here, into spoilers from the first couple of episodes. Seasons because we want to compare and contrast. So just fair warning to that, but I'd say now there's only been one episode so far. Now is the time to get into Fargo. Really like the premiere. Really excited to see where it goes from here.
And if you like The Leftovers, there's an actress that has a crossover. Is in Fargo.
Yeah, the one and only Carrie Coon, who's we're going to talk a lot about over the course of this podcast, this particular one, plays one of the main roles in The Leftovers, or in Fargo as well, which makes me super excited. She plays this sort of like Marge Gunderson analog, if you remember if you remember that role from the movie. I'm blanking right now on who played her, but the sort of like good-natured cop protagonist. Yeah. And she's done a great job with it so far. She hasn't done any policing yet, but I'm excited to see when she actually does. But yeah, this is the Carrie Coon renaissance, and I'm so happy to be in a front row seat to really witness all of it.
What I like is my wife is watching Fargo with me. She goes, you watch some strange shows. But she goes, oh, wait, isn't that the girl that plays, is in Leftovers? I go, yeah. So then I'm watching The Leftovers. She goes, hey, wait, what show is that girl in? I go, Fargo. Oh, that's right. Anyway.
Speaking of Leftovers actors appearing in other things, I don't know if you've seen this week's Veep, Jack, but
Yes, I have.
So Miss Amy Brenneman, Lori Garvey, or maybe Lori Murphy, considering the time jump forward, was not on this week's Leftovers, but she was on this week's Veep playing, she was the president of Smith College, I believe. Yes. I won't spoil anything, but if you haven't checked out Veep, it's, in my opinion, one of the best comedic ensembles on television today. So, and Amy Brenneman, just like your wife said, Jack, could be a reason why you make a transfer over to Veep.
There you go. And she actually liked a tweet that we put out. Unfortunately, a couple days later, I realized I posted the link to the Survivor podcast.
Maybe she's a Survivor fan.
So there we go. But anyway, if you want to see the rest of the shows, you can go jayandjack.com. You can become a patron there by going jayandjack.com. Click on the little patron thing. Helps this podcast and all the other podcasts, Jack Network. Also, if you shop Amazon, go to jayandjack.com/Amazon, or just go to jayandjack.com. Click on Amazon. Every little thing you buy helps all this, all these podcasts that are out there in the podcasting network. Go anyway, on with the show. This is it.
Leftovers recap. Leftovers recap. Leftovers recap.
All right, it's Leftovers recap time. We start off with the theme song. Now, last week we talked about what exactly the theme song might be. We got it maybe this episode with the images from season 2. I believe it was the exact same run of season 2, but instead of that delightful, twangy season 2 song, we got the Perfect Strangers theme. Now, Jack, I almost made a joke about it last week and in previous podcasts that I would love to see the Perfect Strangers motif return, and it turns out it did in full force.
I think you get a tally point for that.
I'm gonna have a couple of tally points. Admittedly, I'm gonna toot my own horn because a couple of my predictions came true. Do not count me as a legitimate source though. Moving forward, I think that this might be the only time that I'm really running hot with the prediction game on The Leftovers.
It only took one. If you get one right, that's like winning the World Series, Super Bowl. It doesn't matter. It can carry you through a whole series.
I got that ring.
Yeah.
All right, so in the middle of the night, we have the Pillar Man in Jardin fall off of his perch. The next day, his wife, Sandy, who some might remember, played by Brett Butler. She is the woman who, in Matt's big episode of season 2, was camped outside of Jardin, asked Matt to break an oar over her son while yelling the name Brian to get the money for him and Mary to go through the back channels back into Jardim. She's being interviewed by Nora, being asked all the questions because she claims her husband has departed and talks about how his undying devotion to God made him suffer as a coping mechanism. And after countless confessionals with other town members who give the exact same story, Nora goes to visit a bloodied Matt, who admits that the Pillar Man actually had a heart attack and his wife secretly approached Matt to give him a Christian burial. So it seems like Nora is finally back to doing her job after, you know, taking a leave of absence, even though she did have that momentary period where she asked Erica the questions last season.
I do like how when she gets to Matt, Matt's obviously in pain because, you know, Mary has left him. You know, she's taken the baby. She's out. She spoke and she's gone. And here's poor Matt. He's cleaning up his blood and he's made a promise to this woman that he won't say. And she goes, all right, don't lie to me. Okay, let's go dig him up. I mean, she just got the ball rolling there that she was not going to take any crap this episode.
Yeah, Nora coming up, especially in these couple of scenes, is going to have a very laissez-faire / kind of sarcastic attitude towards almost everything. We're going to talk about her reaction specifically to the Book of Kevin coming up. There was something I noticed that actually Reddit kind of pontificated on a bit. So Matt had a bloody nose. I know it's just one bloody nose, but what do you think about the fact that maybe Matt was obviously in poor health when he was a kid? He had leukemia. In his family leaving, what if, a la Breaking Bad, it almost came back?
Huh. Didn't think about that. That's a great point.
Again, it's just one bloody nose, but I feel like it might lead a trail of blood, quite literally, to another diagnosis for Matt. And maybe the, you know, you need to get her back into town is more than just, you know, a prophecy for her. It's more so tied into him as well, that if they're gone, he's going to suffer as a result.
I do like the fact when Matt asked about the book, Nora said, I'm staying out of it, and Matt is shocked.
Yes.
Because Nora has an opinion for everything, and he just goes, I don't care.
So Nora and Kevin visit the Pillar to collect Pillar Man's belongings. In talking with Kevin, it's clear that Nora is hesitant to believe the departure story, especially after talking with Matt and learning that it quite literally is not true. And simultaneously, she is mocking Kevin for his new role as an apparent messiah. And in her conversation with him and with John Murphy, it's revealed that it looks like Kevin, when faced with that choice last week to give that book a nice little bonfire over the garbage can or to keep it, it looks like he kept it, which means that I think he's buying into the game just a tiny bit. But Nora, again, having this sort of don't give an F attitude, hops off the Pillar and starts making fun of this sort of shrine that has been made to the Pillar Man. And Kevin urges her to be, quote unquote, calm and nice. I didn't say this at the top, Jack, but what did you think about the tragic death of the Pillar Man, who quite literally was a pillar figure in season two, in our introduction to Jardim?
I just thought it was kind of funny because you got Gary Busey inflatable balloon behind him, and you have that ridiculous balloon, and then the guy falls. I thought it was funny. I know I'll take some heat, but oh well. I mean, he doesn't speak, so
it would have been funny if he fell into the Gary Busey balloon and popped it.
That would have been a lot better. No, but that might have broke his fall though.
Well, no, Gary
Busey saves him.
Well, he had a heart attack, so I don't know if any sort of padding will. I don't think it was the fall that killed him. I'm pretty sure he died from about, you know, 30 feet up.
Maybe he grabbed an aspirin on the way down. Right.
Does maybe help? a couple Tums to, you know, ease the heart pain. I mean, that would be two birds with one stone, right? I mean, you get rid of the Moses-like figure in town. You also get rid of that really creepy but really funny Gary Busey statue. But maybe you and I are just being like callous Noras to all of this, that we're laughing at this man's pain.
I blame it on Nora because that's how she made me feel this whole episode.
That's her coping mechanism in a way, much like Sandy smokes, and Nora's going to smoke later. So Nora finally gets her cast off, but the situation quickly becomes awkward with the doctor when he brings up something that he heard about her apparently slamming her arm in a car door as if to intentionally cause injury. Nora sort of shrugs this off, and on the way out, she receives a mysterious call from Mark Lynn Baker, who she doesn't recognize the name at the time, but he is speaking on, quote unquote, behalf of a third party, and he sort of drops the ominous question that we heard in the preview trailer, which is, would you like to see your kids again? Nora's immediately incredulous to all this. We've seen all the phone calls she's taken over the past couple seasons, but Mark encourages her to meet him at a hotel in St. Louis in the next 24 hours to find out more. So we talked about this during the theme song, but who instead of looking from the be ridiculous, who on earth would have actually thought that Mark Lynn Baker would make a return cameo after that sort of, like, you know, 1 second joke in the second season about him hiding out in Mexico?
It's just perfect. I mean, I don't mean to pun here, perfect stranger, but it was a perfect, it just to bring him in there was just perfect, because, you know, he faked his own departure because, you know, he was the one of the four cast members that didn't depart. And so he's feeling guilt. And of course, Nora had the same, you know, her husband and two kids departed. And so you have that whole thing going on. But I want to go back to Nora's cast. At least we got an answer to that, how she broke her arm. But have you ever had a cast? Have you had a hard cast on?
Oh, yeah. I broke my wrist when I was doing a show when I was a freshman year in high school. That's the only time I've broken a bone. But, yes, I did have a cast on for about a month.
Now, I've had a cast on my foot, well, leg, and my wrist. I broke my wrist, too. And the first thing I did was, when they took that cast off, was scratched my arm. Just scratched, yeah. Scratched my leg, and my leg was all white. That was because, you know, you have a cast on, you no sunlight, you no nothing. So I want to call him out that her arm looked normal.
Yeah, maybe she's got like a UV light down there. She doesn't get the Texan sun tanning it, so maybe she was trying to, you know, color it a bit to match the rest of her skin. Though I believe in the first episode she had trouble scratching it, which Kevin had to help her with. We also don't know. We've gotten a little bit more of a sense of the timetable with the past 3 years, at least with some of the events set into place, but we don't exactly know how long Nora has had the cast, which I guess the plan of action for her was what? She got the tattoo in sort of an impulsive moment, and then she thought, okay, I need to cover this up. So then she broke her arm almost immediately afterwards. That's what I would think. She seems very quick thinking.
I thought she had the cast for a month. Right?
Okay. So she had the cast for a month, and then the tattoo would have been a month ago then.
Yeah, but can you imagine just taking a door, car door, and slamming your own hand, your own wrist in the door?
I mean, could you imagine wearing a bulletproof vest and hiring someone to shoot you in the chest?
I don't know. I could. No, I guess I couldn't. So yeah. Hopefully they have good aim. But she's still in pain. She's still suffering. I mean, you feel bad for her, but she's got a great poker face with a doctor actor. She goes, why in God's earth would I do that? Turned around and walked out.
That's the thing about Nora Durst and why I love her as a character is because on the surface, she seems so fine with literally everything. I mean, like the first season, for instance, when Jill was being a little minx at the dinner table when she was first kind of seeing Kevin, and Jill was, you know, trying to snoop into her business and talking about, like, oh, you know, you have a gun in your car. And Nora was like, yeah, I do. Here it is. And she seemed like super cool with everything. But then it turns out that, as I mentioned before, she has this sort of vice where she needs to get shot in the chest in order to sort of relieve that. Second season, Kevin tells her, hey, I've been seeing the spirit of Patty Levin. She's sitting right over there. Nora's like, okay, all right, that's fine. Next day, she takes off with the kid and refuses to talk to Kevin until that problem gets solved. Nora's this really interesting character in that you think she's sort of made of Teflon and is able to sort of take anything that gets thrown her way, but it turns out she's much more of a vulnerable person than you initially think.
And you really see it in this episode, especially towards the end.
Yeah, because
I think she finally crumbled under all the pressure.
And not to mention, you know, there have been, again, quacks that have called her in the past about this family stuff. But I mean, what Mark Lynn Baker is going to do might seem ludicrous on the surface, but it might be the closest that she comes to actually seeing the people that left her. And even though she has sort of moved on and raised her own family, the Lily stuff is a reminder that from her point of view, she's Nora cursed. As you mentioned, she really cannot move on from her fate that she's been saddled with. And maybe that's one reason why she really pursues this at the end of the day.
Yeah, I think she will.
All right, so Nora makes a quick call to the DSD, and here we get a cameo from her old friend George Brevity, the Daniel Baldwin of the Murray Brothers, who to discuss who Mark Lynn Baker is. George reminds both Nora and the audience that Mark Lynn Baker was a member of the cast of Perfect Strangers, and October 14th, it was believed initially that all four main cast members, that is Mark Lynn Baker, Bronson Pinchot, I think it was Melanie Wilson, and Rebecca Arthur, had all departed But later investigation, there was a throwaway joke again in season two on the TV that Marklin Baker had been discovered in hiding in Mexico. He had faked his departure. So after getting that information, Nora comes home to find Kevin, quote unquote, getting a new shirt. Though, again, we know it's less so about the shirt for him and what the shirt comes in particular, a certain bag.
Oh, yeah.
She announces an impromptu St. Louis trip for work and gets in some good-natured Messiah ribbing before she leaves. The Nora Kevin stuff this episode is so strange. She treats him in such a weird way this episode, and like they only have like three conversations.
But is she teasing him, or is she trying? Is she serious?
Well, it's also the claim that, you know, every joke or every time you say just kidding, there's a certain amount of sincerity and truth to it. But it's almost one of those things where, like, she'll throw something out and gauge Kevin's reaction. And it's clear that Kevin himself is maybe sobering up to this whole idea of the position he's been hoisted upon. Or even later on when he says, you know, I want to have a kid, and she laughs in his face, she sort of walks it back. So, you know, I think she's trying to sort of tease him, use a sense of humor to sort of placate this idea of like, it's ridiculous that you think that you are, you know, this Christ-like figure. But it's clear that Kevin is starting to drink the Kool-Aid a bit.
I think he is. But I do like how she said, maybe I'll take the book and read it on the plane. And she's and he's like, but and like when she said, when she was talking to John, and she said, oh, Kevin left it in the bathroom. And at 20 minutes in, I was you know, at 20 minutes later, I'm into the book. So, and Kevin's like, I didn't leave it in the bathroom.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, he didn't want to. He's like, Nora, stop embarrassing me in front of my disciples.
Yes.
They think of me highly.
Yeah.
So Nora starts making the trip to St. Louis, but her journey gets off to a difficult start when she is trying to buy a ticket in the airport kiosk, but she can't get past the screen where it asks the questions. I think it's like, will you have an infant to sit on your lap? She can't press the no button. An airline worker comes over and indicates that this is a quote unquote a dead spot. And if she just selects yes, no harm, no foul, she can move on. But Nora refuses to acquiesce and just decides to get another kiosk. And I want to segment the scene in particular because obviously we're going to find out what happens with Lily. But I mean, I think the dead spot is very representative of Nora, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. It was, you know, and you could see that she was just at that point, you know, she's suffering. And this woman comes over and she's just trying to be helpful. I'll just move on. Like if that woman was so mad, okay, that's fine. But you know, I haven't had my kids depart and all and a child taken away from me and stuff like that. So obviously Nora feels differently than I would.
Yeah. And I think the term dead spot is also like very brutally honest. Like something, a dead spot is something that's never, and then like a gardening term is something that's never going to grow again. And so it's almost like telling Nora, hey, you've lost two children and given up a third. You're never going to have a kid again as much as, you know, your boyfriend might want to do so.
And then when she walks, you see her walking towards the, you know, the gate, her face is like, oh my God, get out of her way. She's going to kill somebody. I mean, she's just clenching her jaw and she's just like, great acting.
While Judy Garland's Meet Me in St. Louis plays in the background. So I couldn't think of a better paired song. I also want to, I didn't highlight before, but did you notice the Johnny Appleseed song playing in the beginning? I don't know exactly what the song was, but I think Johnny, like there's some comparisons that could probably be made between Johnny Appleseed and, you know, what quote unquote Kevinism might be. And this idea of someone who sort of wanders across the land dispensing, whether it be apple seeds or wisdom. And hopefully there are no dead spots in which apple trees cannot grow, proverbially speaking.
Was there a lot of different music in this episode, or did I just notice it more?
No, there was a lot of music. So there was the Johnny Appleseed song. There was this Hallelujah, I'm a Bum song.
Yeah.
where Nora's like going up, where they're going up to the pillar. There's the Meet Me in St. Louis. There's the Perfect Stranger song, not only in the beginning, but also the piano instrumental version later on. We obviously are going to be talking about the Wu-Tang Clan's Protect Your Neck moment. And there's a closing credit song that I didn't take down. But yeah, there's like, I mean, one of the many great things Leftover does is its music choices and its ability to really utilize modern or, you know, recent pieces of music in order to really represent the times. And this is yet another great indicator, considering that they went from, they're going to go from hardcore rap to, you know, 30s musical theater in the span of an episode.
It was great. I don't know if I was just paying attention more. I was like, oh, there's Johnny Appleseed. All right, cool.
All right, so we get to St. Louis. Nora checks into the proper hotel and meets up with a tailored suit-wearing Mark Lynn Baker after disposing of her phone, and he says, everything that matters is up there in the clouds, right? He gives his spiel. So, a group of people have been attempting to harness low amplitude Denzinger radiation, which is a rare type of neutron radiation that scientists found around hotspots where many departures occurred. This group has now apparently constructed a reactor in Australia that, for a price, would expose a person to this LADR and hopefully sending them through to the other place, let's say, to hopefully meet up with those who departed. Despite his credentials, we find out that Mark Lynn Baker apparently has 2 Yale degrees, which I guess is true, which is interesting. She questions the validity of this program. Mark discusses the abandonment that he was feeling and the tings of jealousy even that he was feeling with the other 3 people departing. And it's clear that Nora can immediately sympathize with that. Nora decides to spend the night watching some testimonials from people who have already gone through the program, where they essentially volunteer their consent while simultaneously admit that they're not entirely sure what's going to happen. Jack, give me your reactions when you first heard this entire concept come out of Mark Lynn Baker's mouth.
Well, first, he has 2 Yale degrees, and he had to write it down. So right there, I'm losing a little faith in him. But if I'm Nora, and you know, and you can see, first, if he were to throw my phone, I was surprised she didn't punch him in the face when he threw her phone in the toilet, because as wound up as she was. But no, I think she's believing it. I think she wants to believe. I think at this point she feels, I mean, here she's, you know, like you said earlier, she took, had people shooting a gun into her bulletproof vest and her, you know, what she was wearing, and, you know, she slams her arm in the door and all this different stuff she's going through. I don't think she cares. I think she wants to believe it's true.
Yeah, she wants to believe,
She was shooting it down the whole time, but I think she wants to believe, and I think, obviously, we see she's at least going to Australia.
Can't wait to see Carrie Coon become a member of the X-Files, second season reboot, because she wants to believe. I mean, Mark Lynn Baker gives this really interesting quote where he says, you know, he went through all this rigmarole because he wants to take control. And I feel like that is, like, Nora to a T in this episode, because Nora is running to, like, a Matt Jameson string of bad luck this episode. Between the kiosk, we're going to talk about how, you know, she couldn't get out of the airport with the parking ticket. her GPS blips out when she tries to go search for Lily. So right. I know we spoke, I think, in the preview about this idea that maybe Matt and Nora really are lenses in a way that, you know, they cause bad luck all around them. Nora really might be cursed, though she hasn't had too much bad luck until this episode, but I think what exactly hit her is that she does want to take control. But, you know, we talked before about her lack of emotion. Did you notice when she's watching those testimonials, she's dressed in white and smoking a cigarette?
I didn't notice. No, I didn't notice that.
So, I mean, I'm not saying that Nora's going to join the GR anytime soon, but it's interesting to sort of compare and contrast the general mentality of the Guilty Remnant with the emotional state that Nora's in right now.
Wow, that's a good catch. I didn't see that. I did not see that. I was too busy focusing on the testimonials and the being sound mind and body. but I do give Mark Lynn Baker this, though. Every time Nora questioned him, he had an answer for her.
Yeah, and I could take a moment to talk about Mark Lynn Baker here. I mean, I feel like, again, for what was initially considered a throwaway joke, I mean, Mark Lynn Baker should be known for his stuff outside of Perfect Strangers. I mean, he's a very talented actor and comedian. He's done a lot of theater stuff. He's part of one of my favorite movies ever, Noises Off. He plays the stage manager and he's hysterical in it, but he did a really nice job tackling the dramatic work. I was very surprised.
Yeah, well, when he starts with they have a tailor in this hotel, and that's my first tailored suit ever. I'm just like going, where's he going with this? But it was just, I guess, like breaking the ice and how he was, you know, he's talking to someone who's, you know, you're messing with, if you're, because she was saying, you know, you're being played.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she, you know, you're part of the scam and all this stuff. But he had an answer for everything that she answered. And I think after the testimony, I think she believes, or at least wants to believe. Like we said earlier, she wants to believe that it's true. And I think she has nothing to lose at this point.
Yeah, absolutely. Though you know, it seems like she's sort of putting a strain on her current relationships in maybe pursuing this, though Kevin seemed totally fine with the idea of her just taking 20 grand and going to Melbourne. But we'll talk about that, I'm sure, at the end of this episode. Nora next heads off to Kentucky, where she stops and looks on at a local playground. She attempts to give a stolen shovel back to a little girl, and we soon find out that this is not just some little girl. Christine, season one Christine, Lily's baby mama, walks into the picture, and it becomes very clear that this is a toddler version of Lily. Nora realizes that Lily does not recognize who she is when she gave her the shovel, so she embarrassingly makes the beeline for her car and drives out of town as the Perfect Strangers theme plays, because her and Lily might as well be perfect strangers.
That, and she, I think that was just the tip of the, I mean, that's just the tipping point, because when she looks at Lily and Lily says, "Who are you?" You can just see Nora's like, "Oh, I didn't need that." She wanted Lily to say, "Oh, mommy," or whatever, you know. But she didn't get that. I mean, she took Lily's shovel. I mean, she threw it at the end, but
just it's a spite move. Like, fine, you don't recognize me. Well, now you can't dig in the sand anymore.
Yeah.
So
use your hands.
Thoughts on the theory from last week being correct? What did you think about the actual implementation of this idea that Christine actually did come back at some point to Jarden asking for custody of the child that she had given birth to, albeit abandoned in a bathroom?
Well, I was still kind of hoping it was going the other way, but, you know, what are you going to do? But, no, but when I saw the previews, I go, oh, it's going to be Christine. Because, the previous on Leftovers, I go, why would they be showing all this if it wasn't her?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, maybe if I was doing the show, I would put something previous and not show and not have it anything to do with the show.
But I feel like, I don't even know if that's a Leftovers thing. I feel like that might be an HBO thing. I mean, Game of Thrones is a very similar thing, right?
Oh, yeah.
If you make a reference to, and I'll spoil Game of Thrones here for a second, when, you know, Barristan Selmy shows up in season 3, but we didn't see him since season 1, if we see him on the previously on, chances are he's going to come back.
Right.
Or, you know, when they talk about Uncle Benjen went off into the wilds of the north, and you have someone say, "Oh, John, your Uncle Benjen's back." Nope, stab, 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 stab. Then it makes sense why they would put it in the previously on. But yeah, this seemed a little obvious. I do agree with you.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, I'm cool. It was going to be that or the other one. So yeah, I guess she's with her mom. I guess that's okay. Jeez.
Though I just wonder, now I have a big question mark as to, I just assumed that Christine was sort of like a deadbeat. I mean, this is a woman that was sort of like almost abducted and put into a cult as a concubine purely to farm the sperm of Holy Wayne at that point.
Right.
You know, I'm assuming that she just sort of ran off. I would not think that she would be able to track down Tommy and the gang in Jarden, make her way down there and sue. But I guess a mother can do a lot of things for their child, and she might have just had an attitude come around sometime over the next 4 years after she abandoned her.
Well, I think what a mother will do for her children, we're going to see what Nora will do for her children eventually. Yeah. I mean, at any cost. And you could also see in Christine's face, she was afraid of Nora. I mean, like, are you doing here? What you could see it was pretty good acting by both. I mean, just, you could see that Nora was upset, but Christine was like, "What are you doing here? You know, I'm in town."
I don't know if you also noticed that, Jack, but Christine was also holding another child. So
right.
Maybe she's in a situation where she's settled down with somebody. Maybe she's joined another weird cult and is, you know, betting the leader. Maybe she just sort of hops from rock to rock in that regard. But yeah, I guess like Lily is actually part of an actual family now, it seems.
Right. And not that she wasn't, not that she wasn't with Nora and Kevin, but you know, it just. But like we find out later, Nora didn't put up a fight, so.
Yeah, and a little, I'd say a marginally less of a screwed up family. I know that Nora and Kevin and even Jill all mean well, but there were so many weird things going on at the time. I mean, Kevin was like leaving, you know, the baby around. The baby almost got trampled upon because Nora's baby got stolen by some rando in the encampments outside Jarden.
Well,
so
that kind of stuff happens. You know.
I'll take your word for it. So Nora's final stop in her journey homeward bound is the home of Erica Murphy. Another question we asked, where's Erica last week? But she's, it seems like she's still in Jardin, but her and John have officially split up. The two women who have not really talked since the end of that Lens episode talk about the difference in losing children. It seems like Erica shares a difference of opinion with John in that she does believe that Evie is dead and gone, considering that she buried her. This is where Nora reveals that she did indeed break her arm on purpose in order to get a cast cover up a tattoo of what she calls the Wu-Tang Band. Shows how much she knows it. She just sort of picked out the what she thought was a phoenix on the wall. I think she might need to get her eyes checked.
Yeah.
Hopefully her HMO with the cast covers that. But she got that in order to cover up the names of her children. She apparently felt that the tattoo was too much of a conversation starter that warranted pity or mockery for being unlucky with the whole Nora cursed thing. Erica has the perfect remedy for her malaise, a trampoline, and they do a slow motion bouncing montage to Wu-Tang's Protect Your Neck. Jack, best scene ever or best scene ever?
That reminded me of the Man Show.
And now, moms jumping on trampolines.
I mean, if for you kids playing at home, just Google it. It's Adam Carolla and Jimmy Kimmel.
Yeah, hopefully people don't. Yeah, hopefully they don't associate it with the the guy who did Girls Gone Wild and Joe Rogan, the host of Fear Factor, did the other version.
No, not that one. The one with Kimmel and Carolla. But I was interested when Erica said I buried Evie. No, it was the U.S. government that buried Evie.
Who knows? Maybe.
They had the drone strike, so I'm pretty thinking that there wasn't much left of Evie. So
maybe it was more of a metaphor thing.
Did she really bury her though?
I mean, we might have to, you know, play one of the songs of The Leftovers backwards to hear Erica say, I buried Evie.
She said it twice. You have John who believes she's alive, and Erica believes that she buried her. I'm thinking she was ground zero of this drone strike. I was making a joke, but I don't think there'd be much left of her to bury. I mean,
not much leftovers?
No, there you go.
What did you feel about? I mean, Jack, are you? I know you're a big like classic rock guy. Are you a Wu-Tang Clan guy?
I am not, but I did enjoy the song. I don't know, just
same. I mean,
Nora was smiling and Nora was happy and everything was. I said, "Wow, I got you know." Sometimes I have bad days. I'm gonna get me a trampoline.
I feel like I either read or saw something, or maybe it was just from the trampoline subplot that I watched on an episode of The Simpsons where they said, like, you jump on a trampoline and you really can't be mad or sad. Speaking of Wu-Tang Clan, I don't know if you noticed at the very beginning, the written by credits were by The Lonely Donkey Kong and Specialist Contagious, which apparently there's like a Wu-Tang name generator on online that Lindelof and Perota put their names into, and that's how they got their Wu-Tang name. So that's where the names came from. It was still the same guy, it's just sort of Wu-Tanged up.
That's amazing. I did not know that.
Yeah, it was a
next week we should all put our names in there.
Yeah, I did not know that was a thing, but you know, the internet is certainly a wealth of ways to really spend your time, so it's sort of par for the course in that regard. And I'm just hearing from our producer in silence, Jay, saying that that's apparently how Donald Glover got his rap name of Childish Gambino. So it's pervaded into the mainstream pop culture as well.
Wow. So I could go in there and get a podcasting name.
Yes. If you want to put yourself under a pseudonym to say even racier things than you usually do with under the source of anonymity, you should be able to do that.
Yeah.
But I alluded to this in, you know, my greeting into this podcast, but this really did remind me of, admittedly, I'm not a big Perfect Strangers person. I've watched a handful of episodes, but not as much compared to the other TGIF sitcoms or other sitcoms of that era. But I believe like the one big thing from that show was the Dance for Joy, right? From Meepos, where they would do like this little kicking thing every time they were celebrating something.
Yeah, it's been a while since I probably saw a lot of the episodes. But I do remember something like that.
Yeah, so that's basically what this was in a way. It was sort of like a Dance for Joy. And granted, none of them are feeling very joyous, but at least it was a way for them to be able to let go of their burdens and quite literally, you know, soar almost to the heavens off of the pure lightness of their hearts as a result from this trampoline.
The only thing I remember from watching Perfect Strangers, every time, what's his name? Pearson Balky. Tom Cruise, when they did Risky Business, told him, never do TV. Never do TV. I will help you and support you, but you should never do TV. So every time I watch Perfect Strangers, I'm like going, I guess he didn't listen.
And Perfect Strangers, that was also post... I mean, I feel like Bronson Pinchot's first big break was Beverly Hills Cop, right? He had like that scene-stealing role.
Yeah. Yeah, with Eddie Murphy, yeah.
So that just goes to show, never trust advice from Tom Cruise, because as he said, look where that got him.
Yeah.
Well, speaking of Tom, Nora's about to meet up with another Tom. On the way home, Nora gets pulled over by Tommy. She asks to go get a drink with her, and she refuses, and it turns out that Christine had told him, I guess they had sort of kept in touch about her impromptu Lily visit. We found out a bit more about what happened in the past 3 years. Looks like Christine came to Jarden and sued for child custody. Nora decided to relent. She basically looked across the table and saw a hurt mother who had abandoned her child and wanted her back. Tommy decides to sort of relay his own story, comparing and contrasting, talking about Tommy's birth father, who we saw, I believe, in the Garveys at their best, and how, you know, he was actually kind of sorry that they had revealed that he was adopted and who his birth father was. I believe he uses the quote, "I wish they hadn't told me because I was already where I belonged." Right. Nora sort of takes offense to that, and Tommy unfortunately kind of adds insult to injury in that regard when he tells her, you know, "When I dropped off Lily, it was for my dad. I didn't even know who you were." Right. As a result, in sort of the fury, Nora decides to blow up this giant, almost an autopsy photo of the Pillar Man in the morgue and sticks it right on the altar. She walks away in a true badass fashion, fire licking at her face, and Sandy damns her to hell and calls her a heartless woman.
Yes, that's exactly what she said, heartless woman.
So, yes. Obviously the parallels are there between Tommy's plight and Lily's plight, but do you think Tommy took the right tone here? Do you think he should have gone that far with Nora?
I thought he pushed her a little too far. I mean, again, he's probably not thinking straight. I mean, Nora, he probably doesn't know what Nora's gone through as far as, you know, where she was this weekend. But still, Nora's lost two children. She lost another child. You know, she gave up another child to the mother. And Tommy, I thought it was a kind of a dick move by Tommy.
Yeah,
it was a great scene between the two actors. I thought it was a fantastic scene. I did think when Nora went to go have the picture, I thought it would have been funny if she tried to get the she couldn't get the picture enlarged and then had to have the guy come over and help.
Yeah, exactly. Oh no, your finger's stuck on. Do you want family size photos? Like, it's a dead spot.
Dead spot. I mean, you know, we forgot about the part where she's at the airport and, you know, she's trying to get out. And then the guy and she gets out of the car, just lifts up the guy. And the guy's like, "Oh, wait, whoa, no, it's cool."
He puts his hands up. Yeah, because he's beeping at her and she goes positively aggro, not only going up to yell at him, but also physically hoisting the gate above her head to be able to get out of the airport.
I didn't know you could do that.
I mean, I think it takes a certain amount of strength, but again, she must have had all the adrenaline flowing in the world to be able to do that. Hell hath no fury like a Nora scorned, it seems.
Well, you know, when the guy saw that, he said, "Ooh, I'm glad I just put my hands up."
Yeah.
She would have kicked my ass.
Absolutely. She would have dragged him out of the car, almost like what Matt did to that carjacker in his season one episode.
There you go.
The Durst Jameson clan just have a penchant for violence sometimes when you really push them over the edge.
Or the guy from United Airlines that could have done the same thing.
Recent. Hopefully they did not fly United on the way to Australia or to St. Louis. So at home, Nora walks in on Kevin doing what I like to call bagging it. It could have been much worse things.
When you first hear it, don't you think he's cleaning the gutters with someone? You hear he's breathing heavy, and then I go, but her look was like, it's kind of like,
I would hope not, because again, Kevin, I think is past the date, especially considering that the person with whom he was committing adultery with disappeared during the departure. You feel like that would be enough of a scarring moment for him to legitimately think like, ooh, maybe, you know, messing around outside of my monogamous relationship is not a good idea. And I feel like he does have a certain level of devotion to Nora, considering that she has stuck by his side in a way
I never
through even, all of this.
But when she's walking up the stairs really quiet and you hear the noise, I never thought he'd have a plastic bag over his face. I go, why didn't I see that coming? Oh, my God. Anyway. And yeah, her look is like, okay.
Again, it's one of those things where she's like an iceberg. On the surface, she seems to be simmering. Or she's like a duck. You know, on the surface, all seems to be calm, but underneath her feet, you know, vigorously pedaling in order to stay afloat. So, yeah, he embarrassingly tries to explain himself, but Nora seems to understand. He tells her he wants to have another baby, and she flat out laughs in his face, then sort of, again, walks things back a bit by saying that, you know, they're happy now and they wouldn't want to ruin that. She talked about another trip to Melbourne, Australia, and how she'll need $20,000 to do it. Kevin's only question for this seems to be, can I come? And she gives her assent.
Yeah. Oh, can I come, please? Do they have bags there? Do they still have plastic bags?
Yeah, what's their laundry situation like? I'm assuming he's like in the plane, and she's like, the flight attendant, oh, do you need any blankets, warm towels? Oh, no, do you have a laundry bag handy? I just need to go in the bathroom very quick.
And some duct tape. Some duct
yes,
tape.
Yes, please. Do you have any duct tape aboard this flight? So, I mean, I feel for Kevin. I mean, Nora's doing all this crazy trip hopping. I would want to at least get in on some of the action. Though, you know, having the chief of police get up and just leave the town flat out, I don't know if that's exactly responsible.
Especially when he said earlier he's got 10 days to keep this thing under control. That's why he was trying to keep Nora calm, even though he told the people, God bless. Because she goes, God bless. He goes, well, you know, we're trying to keep people calm. In 10 days, they'll figure out the world didn't end, and they'll go back to doing something else where they have to. So, yeah, you're right. He's leaving where he's the potential powder keg behind.
And not to mention not only a powder keg, but the fact that, again, he's been now put into this large position, not only from an occupational perspective, but now from a religious perspective in this town. Again, we're not entirely sure whether he's buying into the hype or whether or not he's still selling on it. But you would think that, like, all this stuff just got thrown his way. Him just suddenly drop the ball and leave the game is an interesting way to deal with it.
And that's a big deal. I mean, it's not like you're going from here to, like, when she went from here to, from Texas to St. Louis, you're going from United States to Australia. That's a long hike.
Yeah, absolutely. So if you get called back at a moment's notice, you won't be able to hop, skip, and a jump like a kangaroo back to the States.
I mean, it's just not something you go, I'm going to Australia.
Yeah, no, nobody, at least on impulse, would do that.
No.
So, speaking of Australia, you think that the episode ends there, but we cut to what seems to be Australia as a police officer ends up smacking into a kangaroo with his car and proceeds puts it out of his misery. Again, a nice little season one sort of callback with Kevin hitting the deer and putting it out of its misery.
Right.
And even though I don't know if kangaroos are the deer of Australia, that might be too Americanized of a claim.
Well, I think there's a lot of them, though.
Yeah, I think there are, I mean, a lot, especially
every show I see in Australia, there's a kangaroo. And I used to watch, I've talked about this before, I used to watch Skippy the Kangaroo. It's an Australian show back when I was a kid.
Well, hopefully Skippy did not bite the dust, I hope.
Skippy the bush kangaroo, so... It was like going back to dogs. It's, you know, leftovers have dog. It was the dog of Australia. It was Lassie, basically. Yeah.
Though we do have a dog here as well, as this man turns out to be the police chief of whatever precinct this may be. He seems to be a little bit of a hard ass.
He's a jerk.
A foul mouth jerk at that. Yeah. And again, maybe that's why his namesake sort of holds here. His colleague Jerry wants to, I think, go home and check up on his dog. And not only does this man say no, he says, go clean the kangaroo guts off the grill of my car.
I'm taking your car. Go clean the kangaroo guts. Oh my God. What a nice guy. You don't have a wife.
Exactly. We don't know if he does. I don't think he actually filled in the blanks there. But if he tries to head home to a wife, he's not going to make it, because on his way, he's blocked by a quartet of horseback women. And the leader, or at least the most outspoken, I think her name is Grace Payford, asks if his name is Kevin. He says it is. And they proceed to knock him out, tie him to a board, and basically allude to, you know, they were reading passages from what sounds like the Book of Kevin, including a particular section about jumping into the water with a stone, which is what Kevin did with the cinder block in the first episode of season two. They attempt to drown Kevin in the water. I guess they believe that he is the Kevin that they are looking for. And, you know, much like in the past with his nine lives, this Kevin would then reanimate himself after going to the other side by being drowned. Turns out not to be the case. They got the wrong Kevin. Yeah. But suddenly someone comes limping, bursting out of the house, crying out, "What are you ladies up to?" Is the return of Kevin Sr. to the Leftovers. Yep.
It was that was a great scene because she says, "I'll see you in 2 minutes." And the one lady kept saying, "I don't think it's him. It's him. I don't think it's him. It's him. I don't think it's him." Lift him up. I guess I was wrong.
Oops. So then the question is, how much Kevin's side has been going on in this place? Are they just going down the phone book and looking for anybody named Kevin and undergoing the same process?
So now if you're in Australia, if someone says you're Kevin, you say, "No, I'm Mark."
Yeah, exactly. Go by your middle name.
Yeah. I thought it was just a great scene. I go, huh. And then when you see Kevin Sr. come out, you go, okay, all right.
So do you think this is going to be a trend? I mean, obviously we had the super mysterious scene last time with Nora/Sarah, which I don't think even connects to this scene, but two episodes in a row, we flash to Australia at the end. Do you think this is going to be a recurring motif until we eventually get completely to Australia?
Well, I think Nora and Kevin are heading there. So I think it's going to, I think we're going to get Australia. I think we're wrapping up maybe United States scene, and we're going to go to Australia now.
I would hope that we're not wrapping up United States, because as great as the Leftovers ensemble is, I really don't want to see, you know, two characters just take off and leave everyone else behind. I didn't mention this before with the Tommy scene, but I know we had some reservations about whether Chris Zilka, Zizza, whatever his name is, we were like, how involved is he going to be in this season? So I was happy to see him in a scene, but if they really are, you know, our two main characters are leaving everyone else behind, that's less reason to keep going back to Jarden.
Yeah. Well, they get 6 episodes left, right? Until it's over. Like I said, maybe they're giving, you know, because I don't know. I don't know what's going to go on. Going by the scenes for next week, I think we're in Australia.
Yeah. So spoiler alert for next week. Tune on for the next like 30 seconds if you don't want to hear this.
Right.
So next week is going to be, it looks like we're going to see things from Kevin Sr.'s side. Hopefully we'll see what exactly drove him to Australia in the first place. What happened when he was going there? It seems like he, sort of like some other people in Jarden, have this idea that the apocalypse is coming on the 7th anniversary of the departure. So hopefully we'll find out more about that and spend more time down under, because there's been every ending has just surrounded this place in so much mystery that I want to peek more into it.
Yeah, I was like, oh no. Anyway, like when you see it, they've 2 weeks in a row they've done it where you've left you on like, no, don't stop. And that's perfect television.
Absolutely. Well, that is what we thought, but we want to hear from you guys, so let's get into the listener feedback.
Listener feedback.
Hey, Jay and Jack, it's Jim from Philadelphia. I was listening to your new show, and I was listening to Jack Crackpot Theory, where he thinks that Erica has Lily, and I think that Christine came back, and Nora gave Lily back to Christine, because I think Nora can understand what Christine would be going through in losing a child and wanting that child back. And I think it would tear her up inside, but I think she ultimately would give the baby back to her real mother. That's just my thoughts. Love the show, and I'm excited to hear what you guys think about next week's episode.
Hello, Leftovers Podcast. This is Will from Portland, Oregon. What another terrific episode. So the thing at the end in Australia, I was wondering if that's supposed to be the present or the past or the future. I mean, because I guess at the end of last week when they showed the flash forward, I was thinking, you know, I guess there's no or very little chance for a happy ending with Kevin and Nora. But I don't know, after this one, I was thinking, like, what if they're both hiding out in Australia under different names and people are just looking for the real Kevin? I don't know. Regina King, she is a goddess. You know, there are a couple of times in her little... She wasn't in the episode much, but there are a couple of times where she almost had me in tears with just, like, a look or emotion. So I'm glad we found out what happened with Lily, and we getting to see Erica This is a show that does provide some answers. So, yeah, it was another great episode. I'm hoping this thing with Mark Lynn Baker doesn't turn out to be, you know, an answer to what happened. I really don't want to know what happened during the departure. That's probably the one thing they could do that would piss me off. It would be to explain the departure. Glad that Nora didn't freak out when she walked in on Kevin. Maybe, I don't know, maybe that will lead to something later, but, you know, it would have been so TV for her to, like, freak out and then, like, storm out. But, yeah, once again, terrific episode. Can't wait to hear what you guys think. Later. Bye.
Hey, Jay and Jack. It's Michael calling from Los Angeles. Sorry, Jay, Jack, and Mike. You are also now part of this. Really great episode. I think it was better than the first one. I'm sure some people don't like the in-depth character episode, but I thought this one was really good and provided some insight into Nora. I think the storytelling is really interesting because we're 3 years removed from last season. There's so many questions that come up because you know, you just don't know how did these characters get to where they are today. Before I go any further, I do want to mention, it was a lot of fun listening to you guys podcast about it last season. I caught up on Game of Thrones. I'm a very late adopter to that. And so I've listened to all of Game of Thrones and now all of Westworld and all of Leftovers. So I just, at a certain point, I'm just going to wake up in the middle of the night and have Jay and Jack talking in my head. So one of the things I thought was interesting was, when Kevin comes back to the house and he sees Nora about to leave, he said that he's just coming home to change his shirt. It seems like he's lying. It just initial impression, he didn't seem like he's being trustworthy. I'm curious why Nora didn't deny that she slammed her arm in the car. That doctor called her out on it, and she just sort of waved it off, and all she said was, "Why would I do that?" Which is not really a denial. I think it's interesting that she trusted that guy in the hotel room, I forget his name, when he gave her the USB drive, because it could have like a virus or something else nefarious, to use a word that Mike likes. Just weird that she like trusted him. And then I think whether it was intentional or not, this episode was a lot funnier than any of I've seen. And I think that's kind of interesting. There's a lot of music that ran counter to what was happening on screen. Like, it was very sad, but the music was uplifting. And then last but not least, what's up with chief of police named Kevin? Why do they keep getting killed? If you're a chief of police named Kevin, you should look out. All right, guys. Have a good show.
Hey, Jay and Jack and Mike. This is Scarlett again. So Nora is the most interesting character, and I'm so glad we got to see another episode from her perspective. Throughout most of the episode, she is so adamantly opposed to any kind of like mystical or religious explanations regarding the guy on the watchtower, which makes sense because if people start to believe that the departures continue to happen, then people like her, the real victims of the departure, are no closer to finding the truth of what actually happened to their loved ones. However, despite her disbelief, as soon as she got the call about seeing her kids again, the doubt that was plastered on her face became so apparent. I think deep down she wants to believe that what she went through was not random or purposeless. But believing that your loved ones disappeared for a reason, even if you can never learn what that reason is almost worse than chalking it up to a random freak accident. Nora also appears to be so intense in her disbelief at the beginning of this episode that she suppresses Kevin's belief. When he says God bless to someone, she scoffs at him. She continues to poke fun at the book of Kevin and tries to affirm that she and Kevin agree that it's a book of nonsense. But Nora doesn't know what Kevin has gone through. Nora has no idea about the hotel on the other side of death. I think that's why Kevin was hesitant to give her the book, which may shed light on what has actually happened to Kevin, especially since she left him when he told her about Patty, and I think the title, Don't Be Ridiculous, is her perspective on the world right now. On Reddit, also, some people were commenting on how when Nora found Kevin with the bag over his head, him saying that he was just doing it to feel something and that he doesn't want to die basically indicates that he actually wasn't trying to go back to the hotel to prove that he can't die. I disagree with them wholeheartedly, and I can't take Kevin at face value because he doesn't have the best track record at telling Nora the truth. I think when Kevin jumped into the poison lake, it proves that he isn't just doing these things to feel something, but instead keeps checkality status. Anyway, I'm trying to get a drinking game going where every time Kevin tries to kill himself, we take a shot. Although, after this episode, maybe we should also drink every time a police chief named Kevin gets wrongfully murdered. Anyways, my rant is over. Thanks again for podcasting each week, and have a great week.
Thank you for the calls.
All right. So we'll tag them one at a time. First, start with the first one, Jim. Now, admittedly, Jim called in after we recorded the first episode podcast. So even though people might be pointing and laughing, saying, Jim, we already knew that about Christine, it happened in the episode. He did record it before the second episode aired. So I will.
Actually, I just looked it up. He recorded at 10:01 Sunday night.
Oh, wow. All right, Jim.
I'm kidding.
Trying to slight us, Jim. But no, kudos to you as well.
I have to go back. There's a scene we didn't see. Erica is bouncing with Lily on the trampoline. She bounces too hard, goes over the fence, and Christine catches her and takes her. So I think my theory was right.
Yes, that they both technically had ownership of Lily at one point in time. Can't wait for that secret episode. Will from Portland giving some great comments about Regina King. I do agree. I'm so happy that she's back on the show. She's one of the best actresses on there, and I love her and Carrie Coon doing things together. He posited this question. Is Australia supposed to be in the present or the future? I'll admit I'm sort of with Will here. I thought it was the future at first because I had assumed that the first episode Australia scene was from the future. But after seeing Papa Garvey and him being the same age, he's not a skeleton. He's not the Crypt Keeper at this point. I'm assuming it's in the present, right?
Well, Nora was in the future.
Yeah,
right?
But the question
was Nora not in the future? It just was happened after she went through that with the LP. What was the
radiation?
The LADR. Maybe that's what happened to her.
Make you turn really old?
Really old. Or maybe it's not in the future. Maybe it's in the departed. And maybe you age when you go into the departed. I don't know.
So we'll see. I will definitely, as you said, find out next week, I think, more of this Australia timeline. Michael brought up that this episode was funny. I do agree. You know, even I guess that comes with the territory of bringing on a sitcom star. But I feel like there were some pretty comic moments, though. Again, the first episode was surprisingly funny, too. So
yeah, both episodes
was really been, no. Yeah,
very funny. Yeah, I didn't think about the USB cable having having a virus in it.
Yeah, and Michael does bring up an interesting point about, like, jumping forward 3 years, so many questions come up. It always reminds me of in Parks and Recreation. Again, spoiler alert for Parks and Recreation. The second-to-last season ends with a time jump of, I believe it was 2 years, and it was sort of like a gambit. The producers were saying, like, we're probably going to get canceled, so we're just going to jump to 2017. But then they got renewed for a final season, and so they had to sort of backfill the exposition and say what happened over the course of the past 2 years. So I could see with The Leftovers kind of doing the same thing here. And finally, with Scarlett, another very great call talking about the drinking game every time Kevin dies. I don't think we advocate for rampant alcoholism on The Leftovers, but you know what? If people want to pursue it, so be it.
It's six more episodes. Have at it. Party on. Any excuse to, anytime they play a song, take a drink.
That's our blood on their hands, Jack.
Well, I'm not saying drive.
I'm not saying drive.
You know, I'm not saying put a plastic bag over your face and then take a drink.
Don't imbibe in any other activities that are done in The Leftovers. Maybe just drinking and karaoke.
It's like Michael. He said, you know, sometimes he might wake up with Jay and Jack in his head. You know, but don't have the plastic bag over your head. Don't do that, Michael. Don't do that.
All right, let's get to emails here. We have a nice, fun one to start it off. It says, hi, guys. I've been rewatching seasons 1 and 2 along with season 3. I've noticed a lot of parallels to each season's particular episodes. There's a mirror that's taking place, some in season 1, but very noticeable with seasons 2 and 3. All of these are in episode 2 of each season. I put some of them together. Parentheses, I'm sure Mike has already figured this out. He's good at this game. Very excited to join the podcast this season. Why, thank you. I don't think I'm good at this game, but I appreciate the compliments. I'll try to make this read as easily as I can. Kevin, Season 1, Episode 2, Penguin 1, Us 0. Kevin is definitely losing touch with reality, switching from conscious thought to unconscious actions. Vivid dreams and perhaps sleepwalking, finding the dog, shooting truck in his driveway with the keys, along with a few other incidents. He witnesses his father talking to someone who's not there, and he tells Kevin it's all real. Season 2, Episode 2, A Matter of Geography. Kevin admits to burying Patty and that he has also dug her back up. This is also the first episode we see Ghost Patty. He's seeing something who's not there. Kevin's father announces he's going to Australia, and Kevin wakes up in the drain lake with the cinder block tied to his leg. Season 3, Episode 2, Grace Playford says of Kevin, and he looked at them and raised his hand, but they did not raise a response, and so he clutched the stone to his chest and jumped into the water. Nora, Season 1, Episode 2. Nora is videotaping claimants' interviews about their departed loved ones. She is the star victim of the town, and she's playing the role fully, even when she intentionally knocks the coffee mug off the table to get all eyes on herself. Season 2, Episode 2. Laura is visited by an MIT researcher who explains that geography may be the reason for 3 departures in one home, and the reason she's the survivor of such low odds. The researcher is trying to find a way to control the odds, thinking it will surely happen again. Nora finds Lily on the front porch. Nora officially adopts Lily. Her and Kevin now have full custody. She admits to Matt that she knows about he and Kevin secretly burying Patty. Season 3, Episode 2. Nora is videotaping the Tower Man's wife about his death/departure. She confronts Matt about secretly burying Tower Man's body, tells Matt to dig him up. Mark Lynn Baker explains to Nora about the odds of only 1 in 4 departing, and usually radiation as a way to take things back, to take back control of those odds. She tells the story of her tattoo and how badly she doesn't want to be Nora cursed. She doesn't want the attention. Nora talks to Tom about giving up custody to Lily. Nora announces she's going to Australia. Season 1, Episode 2, Tom takes Christine into hiding. Season 3, Episode 2, quote, "She's not hiding, Tom," which is in reference to Christine. Another Episode 2 parallel is the dogs. First season, shooting of the dogs, quote, "They're not our dogs anymore." Second season, quote, "All dogs must enter quarantine." Third season, Jerry says, quote, "Ginny's not feeling well. Too bad, Jerry. Stay here and get clean the brains off the grill." Also, did anyone else notice Rue Killer Kevin's license plate was 666? I don't know if any of this will make sense to anyone other than myself. If not, at least I had a chance to work on my highly inadequate typing skills. Thanks, guys. Love the show. Love the podcast. Jamie. And thank you, Jamie. That is a lengthy dissertation, but I saw all the connections you were pointing out there.
Yeah, I didn't see the license plate, though.
No, I did not at all.
I feel shame.
Oh, I was too focused on the Rue brains. darn Rues. But yeah, I guess it's unfortunate that we saw Police Chief Kevin die. It was the scourge of the earth, considering his license plate number, so be it.
That, and like they did a good job of us hating him. I mean, he was only on the scene for, 2 minutes, 3 minutes? And so when he drowned, it was like, oh, okay. I mean, he was murdered, and I didn't care because he was such a jerk. So kudos to the writers for having me not care about this guy that got murdered.
Absolutely. All right, let's move into this next email. Hey, Jay, Jack, and Mike, love the podcast. I'll just jump right in. One of the organizations founded by Mary Makipolis and the Sisters of St. Joseph of the Sacred Heart helps counsel and nurture the aged and the very ill. In the last scene from episode 1, the sister says, "Sarah, does the name Kevin mean anything to you?" To me, the question is posed in the same manner as a therapist prompting their patient to recall something that is suppressed. The way that Nora/Sarah responds and the expression on her face seems like that of a person that initially has a spark of memory, but then blocks it because it is too painful. I think that Nora gets zapped. Instead of going to another realm or the place where her departed children are, she becomes very ill. The effects of radiation and the need for escape from the endless suffering she has endured cause her to forget everything, including who she is. Basically, her mind can no longer handle everything that has happened, so she creates Sarah subconsciously and is blocking her life as Nora completely. She is taken to the sisters, given a menial task to complete daily/weekly, i.e. dove duty, so that she stays in constant communication with the sisters, hope that she will eventually get better. So why would the sister ask Nora/Sarah about the name Kevin? Because after the zap, Kevin sees that he can't help her, so places Nora in the care of the sisters. This explains why the sister would use the name Kevin in an attempt to spark memories from the past. I hope I am terribly wrong because I hate this idea, but that is my crackpot theory, and I'm sticking to it. Amanda from Texas.
I like that.
I'm with Amanda that I don't necessarily want to see Nora get shipped off to the proverbial Australian crazy house, but... It's sort of like what you were alluding to before, though, Jack, that like that this is that Nora would be irradiated and as a result might lose some mental faculties.
Right. She, that might have happened to her. But then, but Nora's so like we saw this whole episode, she's very cold hearted. I mean, she's a great poker player. So when the nun asked her if you know Kevin, no, I don't know Kevin. I mean, and you would believe her because she's good at lying.
Yeah, it just maybe it's because I love the character of Nora, and I almost feel like this is like a Twilight Zone-esque purgatorial ending to have her stuck in this convent in an alternate persona trying to remember what her previous life was, though she can't.
It's all in a snow globe.
Oh, boy, yeah. It's all in a snow globe that has them meeting up in a church, that has them running after Robin Scherbatsky. What other controversial series endings can we throw in there?
Well, A Journey will start playing and it'll fade to black.
Yes, exactly. It'll cut out before it's revealed who Nora is.
Yes, exactly.
So we'll put a pin in that. Next email. Hi. Before Night Court, Harry Anderson was a professional magician. I know this because my older brother is a professional magician. I was always around when he practiced. He's never stopped. He was always hanging around magic shops and buying whatever books, videos, and tricks he could get his hands on. Harry Anderson invented a trick that made it seem like he was stabbing himself in the arm with a big pin. It involved a lot of spirit gum and fake blood. Harry did a couple of videos of magical instruction, and on them he always worked with a partner who played the sucker or friend. They always referenced the name Turk Pipkin. I always remembered that name. Turk Pipkin. Oh, the leftovers. One, was the pillar man's name Brian? Two, when Nora threw the book of Kevin down, it was loud so I could hear it land inside Kevin's soul. He wants to be able to and let go and believe. I think the denial is getting the better of him. Three, lens parallels. In Lens, Nora is crashed down to Earth. Erica, this time it's from Tommy with the line of the episode. I left her for my dad. I didn't even know you existed. Ouch. In Lens, Nora has been through some real traumatic stuff, only to come home and find Kevin in even worse shape. Last time, he admitted to being followed by Patty, and this time with a bag over his head. Four, the Nora-Kevin conversation. Any sane person would not bring up the idea of having her carry and raise another baby, last-ditch effort on his part. His last temptation, if you will. Are they happy? I'm very glad she said yes to Kevin coming with her so fast, but it wasn't as fast as she said yes to the woman on the phone. Five, oy vey, here we go with the didgeridoos. Australia, not touching it. Scott Glenn time. Theory. The new song for the credits will start next week. A song for each setting. This one will remain for Australia. R.I.P. Brian the Pillar Man, as portrayed by Turk Pipkin. If you read the whole thing, thanks. Ethan. Oh, I didn't even realize it was Ethan.
Oh,
we should have
man.
Cut it short, considering it was just the two of us. P.S. Oh, look, a dead horse. Where's my club? Mike, all I was saying is that the season one episode Gladys is the leftovers version of American Anthem from Black Mirror. If you can't get past the Gladys for the Garveys at their best, you don't deserve season two. But you guys are way more inclusive than me. We can all thank Kevin for that. Ha. PPS, here's a picture of my brother headlining an Italian magic convention with Harry Anderson last year. Stupid practice. Wow, lots of information about Ethan and his brother's history with magic this episode.
Yeah. Yeah. It's too bad his brother couldn't make him disappear, right? Was that wrong for me to say that out loud?
No, I don't want to take another shot at Ethan and continue this rivalry. But what I will say, since you pulled the Black Mirror card, Ethan, one of the advantages of watching Black Mirror is that since it's an anthology series, much like Fargo, you don't need to watch every single episode. There have been people that flat out turned off the series after the national anthem, which is the first episode. I will not spoil the plot for you. Suffice it to say, it's a little touchy. And as a result, people were not able to watch the absolutely beautiful episodes that followed. So, again, this is a total difference of opinion. I still think, and from both Black Mirror and Leftovers, you don't need to start with the first episode, but that's just my opinion.
Yeah, I agree also. Start whenever you want.
Any thoughts towards Ethan's musing Harry Anderson aside here, Jack, about the Pillar Man's name being Brian or the lens parallel or anything like that?
Well, you know, he is right. I hate to say it. Kevin seems to he's hanging around Nora, and he seems to be getting worse, not better.
Yeah, I mean, you would think that once Patty sort of unburdened his soul, it would be
right.
Home free. But Kevin almost seems traumatized by that whole ordeal that he really can't escape from it.
He can't escape anything. It's like he wants to go. When he wants to go to Australia, maybe he just wants to go see his dad. Like I said, I hate to say Ethan is right because it hurts. A little part of me dies inside, but he's right. Even though Nora's his right now his soulmate, you know, they seem a perfect couple on the when they're walking around town, But they're not. They're both hurting. They're bad for each other, really.
So then maybe that's one reason, you know, I know we questioned before, why did Kevin up and leave Jordan, that's almost in a panic over what's to happen at the end of the day in order to go to Australia. But maybe that's one reason why he's sort of in a panic to get things, quote unquote, right. And maybe him going on his own little walkabout in Australia would be a way to do that.
Or maybe he's afraid to lose Nora.
That could be it as well. I mean, Nora has been very flighty as of late, and he's afraid that if she goes to Australia, she won't come back. Which, again, considering some theories about what happens to her, that might be the case.
Or Kevin can't stand to be alone.
Kevin can wait. Oh, boy. On that note of a Kevin James sitcom, let's get to the hallmark of every podcast here on The Leftovers with Jay, Jack, and Mike, Jack's Crackpot Theory of the Week.
Yeah. This whole Nora, I think Nora's going to do the what Mark Lynn Baker told. She's going to do the LADR. I think she's doing it, but I also think Kevin's going to do it. I think they're both. I think Kevin's going to follow Nora because again, he's following her. He can't, and so I think they go into the departed world.
Do you think we're actually going to see the under there or the sunken place where actually the departed people went?
I think we are, but I don't think Nora, because Nora can't have happiness, so I don't think she finds her children. But I think they do go somewhere, and the reason they're trying to find Kevin is because maybe Kevin doesn't belong there in the departed world. So maybe that's why they're trying to find Kevin, because Kevin doesn't belong in the departed world. So that, you know, they, by testing him, they're just, you know, drowned a Kevin who, you know, who cares?
It's like when that kid got sucked into the TV in Poltergeist and they had to go in and get him out.
Exactly.
That'd be interesting.
I think Kevin, there's a reason why Kevin was so quick to follow her to Australia. It's just, and Nora, I'm going to go to Australia. Is that okay? Yeah, okay. Let's take $20,000. I'm going to go. You know, he doesn't even ask questions. They're just going to Australia. So I think that's what happened. I think Nora, because, you know, when you have kids and you're, or you have family members and you lose somebody and you feel like you have nothing, and she had Lily and then Lily got taken away from her. She lost Lily. Well, she gave Lily away, but technically it was taken away from her. Nora's hurting. I mean, she wants her kid. She wants to see her kids again. So she'll do anything she can. I got to be honest with you. If I was in that situation, I'd probably take a chance.
I don't know if I want to take this as if this plot point comes up, I'll be mad type of thing. Sort of like what one of our callers did with, you know, if we get revealed where the departed went to, I won't be as happy. I want to let the mystery be. But I'm almost in that category. I don't know, even if it's very metaphoric, like what they did with the hotel last season, I don't know if I want to see where these people went after they departed. I feel like that deceives the central conceit of the show.
But maybe they all go to a different place. That's why Nora can't find, you know, maybe that's why she can't find. She doesn't find. She goes to a different. Maybe they depart. They don't all depart to the same place. I don't know. Mm. I'm just throwing it out there because.
Yeah.
I think she's going to do it. She's gonna go through with it, and I think Kevin will follow her.
My hot take is that Nora gets irradiated and turns into the Incredible Hulk. And goes on a smashing spree of kangaroos in Australia and needs to be put down. And maybe the Sarah version is like her Bruce Banner form.
She's just wearing makeup. You know, she's just you don't want to see her when she's angry.
Always. Look what happened when she lifted the freaking gate over her head at the airport. Yeah. It shows that she has that type of strength.
And that guy's probably pissed his pants.
Yeah. So Nora Hulk is my crackpot theory.
Nora Hulk. I like the Nora Hulk. I like that. I like that direction.
And I hope they would play the piano and credit sad music when, you know, Bruce Banner would be walking along the side of the road.
Well, going to the end of the Leftovers, with six more episodes, do we think we're going to get the happy ending? Or is it just going to be it's just going to end and we're going to be, more like Lost, where you have to think of some things.
Yeah, I don't think people are going to be disappointed with the ending. Again, this is me maybe putting too trust in these interviews that I read beforehand of Carrie Coon and others saying, like, oh, this is a very satisfying ending. It ties up a lot of loose ends. But considering how they ended the second season when they thought they were going to end, with how happy everyone was in that last scene, you'd have to think they're going to try to repeat it again, just for customer satisfaction in a way.
Okay, all right. Then Nora has to find her kids then.
Well, we'll see.
Her and Kevin have a baby, and they name it Sarah, and that's not really Nora. That's Sarah. That's Kevin and Nora's baby in the future, Sarah.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's again. That goes back to that very first caller question of was that Australia seen in the future or the present? It's something that we will see hopefully very soon.
There we go. Well, that's it. That's our show. If you like to, again, if you like to help this show, you can go to jayandjack.com, become a patron. I think we have 150 some odd patrons who are helping us bring in talent like everybody we have, Mike and everybody else we have going on, because we have the Fargo podcast. We have the broadcast that's doing a live podcast. As soon as we get done recording here, the Married Man Show. You're going to want to listen to the last one. It was, well, you may not want to listen to it, but it was, if you're fans of the Andy Griffith Show, you might be a little upset by it. We had the Survivor. Game of Thrones is coming back. You just go on jayandjack.com, and it will show you the whole enchilada, what we have. And like that, right now, we'd like to thank three special patrons. We like all our patrons. We'll thank three of them. Tack from Tokyo, Eckhart Richner-Glaffelter, and Molly the Millennial. Thanks for doing what you do, and thanks for everybody who listens and sends your feedback. You can send it to... What's our email address?
Is it lostpodcast@gmail.com?
Is that what we use? I don't think we... I think we use a leftover email address.
Leftovers JJ.
Leftovers JJ@gmail.com. Once again, it's leftovers JJ@gmail.com. Or give us a call at 385-309-0311. Call anytime. That's it. That's all we got. Hasta luego and goodbye.
Bye-bye.